Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today I'm speaking with Charles J. Holden, co-author with Zach Massetti and Jared Pedair of the book Republican Populist, Spiro Agnew and the Origins of Donald Trump's America. Chuck, welcome to New Books Network.
Thanks, Mark. Great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you on our podcast. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Sure. Well, I come from a farm in Iowa, and I went to got my undergraduate degree at St. John's University in Minnesota, where I majored in business. But after that, I was working in St. Paul for a couple of years and got the history bug, surrounded by lots of wonderful used bookstores back in the day, back in the early to mid 80s, and just realized that I wanted to take a stab at a career in academia and in scholarship. So from that, I took the plunge and started out at Creighton University, which at the time had a very small master's program, which was a good fit for me because as a business major, I was coming in pretty unprepared to study history at the graduate level. So Creighton University was a great fit for me as a master's student. I loved it and decided I wanted to press on. And so I applied to the PhD program at Penn State University and went there, started there in 1990, and was lucky to be on in a great department with some wonderful historians. Nan Woodruff was my advisor, and Gary Gallagher, and Laurie Ginsberg, and Tivoli Glimp. And it was really an exciting time to be at Penn State and study in American history. And from that, then I started to transition my way into the job market, and I taught on contract for a few years at University of North Carolina at Greensboro, which was a real lucky break for me. I again was surrounded by some great historians. Bill Link, in particular, was my department chair at that time, and he and I came to be really good friends and have shared work ever since. And then in 1999, I was offered the job at St. Mary's College of Maryland, and I've been there ever since.
Was it that association with Maryland that directed you towards a book about Spiro Agnew, or was there another reason why you chose to co-author a book about him?
No, you're exactly right, Mark. What happened was shortly after I got to St. Mary's, a couple of years later, we hired Zach Massetti, one of my co-authors there, and Zach was the first director for the Center for the Study of Democracy that St. Mary's College had just created. So Zach came to St. Mary's, and I was on the advisory panel for this center. So Zach and I got to know each other right away, and we were looking for something to collaborate on, something Maryland-based, something history, political science. Zach's PhD is in political science. And we were kind of batting around ideas for a while. And one day, about 2004 or 2005, Zach said, Spiro Agnew. And let's think about that.
I hope that was in the context of a conversation. He just didn't suddenly, sit there. You guys were talking about tennis, and all of a sudden he blurted out, Spiro Agnew.
Well, we've been kind of tossing around ideas, and nothing really felt right. And literally on our way to coffee one day, we were walking over to our coffee shop in the campus center, and he's just like, hey, Spiro Agnew. And I think, I knew exactly what he was getting at. That's an interesting story that's Maryland-based and not told a dozen times over. And so we got to thinking about it. And in the meantime, what one of the things that Zach got started at the Center for Study of Democracy was a lecture series. We were really fortunate at St. Mary's College to have on our Board of Trustees and on our foundation board, Ben Bradley from the famed Washington Post executive editor. And Ben was a wonderful friend of the college. And so Zach had reached out to Ben about starting this lecture series. Ben, of course, was very agreeable. And one year we invited Richard Cohen as the Bradley lecturer for that year. And of course, Richard Cohen had been on the Agnew beat for the Washington Post in the early 70s, and when Agnew then was forced to resign. So we thought, well, here's a great chance for Zach and myself to start to dig in a little bit on the Agnew story. What better sources than to hear Ben Bradley and Richard Cohen talk about it? So we got to spend an evening with Ben Bradley and Richard Cohen at Ben Bradley has a house near St. Mary's College and it was fabulous just hearing these two, legends really of American journalism talk about the days at the Washington Post, talking about the Agnew case. And in the aftermath of that conversation, Zach and I were highly motivated then to start digging in. So we first, we wrote an article about how the Washington Post covered Agnew. There are some legal issues about who owned Richard Cohen's notes, and so it was a good story to tell. And we got that article published. But both Zach and I thought, there's more to this story. But I was working on another book at the time. I was doing a book on academic freedom in the South. Zach was getting ready to leave St. Mary's College. He went to Oklahoma University next and as a dean, and then ended up at Ripon College in Wisconsin, where he's the president up there. And so we both kind of put Agnew off to the side for a few years until about 2014, I would say. And we were both in a position where we thought we could get back to Agnew. So maybe this is one of those stories that I think a lot of scholars have of put an idea in, don't discard it. You never know when you're going to, it might come back. And so this is what happened here. So about 2014, 2015, we were both in a position where we were thinking this would be a good time to get back to Agnew. Zach up in Ripon had met Jerry Podair, our third co-author. Jerry's a historian at Lawrence University up in Appleton. He was interested in the project. So the three of us then were set to really start digging in, and we thought the time was right because we're looking now, 2014, 2015, we're in the aftermath of Sarah Palin, the rise of the Tea Party, and from our earlier work on Agnew, we saw something in the appeal to both of Sarah Palin and the Tea Party. So we thought echoes of Agnew's political style in both. So we were in the midst of really pressing forward on a book. We'd reached out to UVA, had a book contract we were working out. And then 2015, of course, Trump decides to run for president. And as his campaign unfolded and we're furiously researching and writing the book, we felt like we were really onto something then. So that's kind of the origin story of the book and how the three of us came together.
Spiro Agnew is in some ways a very unlikely subject for reasons that the three of you mentioned at the beginning of your book, because you describe he has this very low reputation in among a lot of scholars and historians today. I was wondering if you could perhaps explain why Spiro Agnew is so poorly regarded, and why that may have led a lot of people to misjudge his place in history.
Sure. It's a story of where politics and culture were at that time. So even during his vice presidency, he was notorious, right? He was very divisive figure. For some, he was this welcome and celebrated icon of middle America, or as Nixon described it, you know, the silent majority. To others, he was this offensive, overly divisive, just endlessly aggressive, almost attack dog on behalf of the Nixon administration, which I mean, he was, and he would say, yes, that's what I should be doing. But I think the way he left the vice presidency was in scandal. And he was, there's an investigation that eventually unearthed him having taken bribes throughout his Maryland political career. And I can talk a little bit about that as well. And the evidence was just solid. And so he had to resign. And really, Mark, back in, he resigned in 73. And back then, you know, when you resigned out of scandal, that was it. You were gone. As the kids would say today, you were ghosted. And so he left. The last image that most people had of Spiro Agnew was one of shame and humiliation. And so there he stayed for a long time until about, you know, 10 years ago. And I do think the context of, you know, the Sarah Palins and the Tea Parties and now Donald Trump has kind of prompted a rethinking about this populist, slashing, always aggressive style of politics. And as we've begun to rethink that, suddenly Spiro Agnew's legacy comes into view again. And so that was part of our goal then is to really get in and look at different aspects of his career to see this kind of conservative populist temperament taking root in the Republican Party through Agnew. If the way we describe today is if Agnew had Twitter, this scandal would not have fazed him that much. He would have maybe lost the vice presidency, but kept his audience. I think he would have been really effective on something like Twitter, but of course we just didn't have it. And so once you left, that was it. You were done.
Yeah, that aspect of his audience was something that really I thought was fascinating, and I'm hoping you develop that in a little bit. But one of the other things, and I was hoping you'd start with this, is because one of the things that I think that legacy and that image of him resigning the vice presidency in disgrace, it obscures is just how meteoric his rise was. And it was something that I thought you developed very nicely in that chapter. I was wondering if you could perhaps explain how it is that this person who is this, post-war American, he's gone to war, mm-hmm. he has this successful career as an attorney, how he then gets into politics, and then how he quickly goes in a few short years from being this, yeah. Guy running for office for the first time to being vice president of the United States.
Yeah, indeed. It is a kind of rocket ship to fame. And part of what landed him so squarely in the public eye was his image of being a normal, average man, which in many aspects he really was. His background is extremely humble. He's born in Baltimore City and son of a Greek immigrant father who was, kind of middle class, but the Great Depression, so times were tough. There was nothing in Agnew's background that would have predicted the kind of fame that he would achieve in the late 60s and early 70s. So he was a very indifferent high school student. He started to college at Johns Hopkins, but by his own admission, wasn't really interested in college and didn't do very well and dropped out. He got pulled into the Army during World War II, like a lot of men did. He served honorably in World War II. He had a very solid career as a soldier and fought at the Battle of the Bulge and recalled just how brutal the conditions were. He remembered sleeping on ice for a week at some point before before they were relieved. And then, like a lot of that generation, came back home and tried to pick up the pieces from their pre-war life. So he started working various jobs, but was attending night school at the University of Baltimore Law School, trying to work his way up and advance his career. He got his law degree. And then, like a lot of that generation, moved out to the suburbs in the 1950s. And the suburbs here would be Baltimore County. A little bit confusing. You have Baltimore City, and then all around the city you have Baltimore County, and it's this huge entity. But it was a fast-growing suburban area. At the same time, he got the inkling that maybe he'd like to try politics, and he got a bit of advice from one of his lawyer mentors, who said, well, if you want to be a fast success in Maryland politics, be a Republican, because Maryland was a heavily Democratic state. And so there would be less competition. And so that pretty much accounted for him becoming a Republican. So in the 50s, then, as a Republican, as an attorney out in Baltimore County, then he's starting to find his way. And some of his earliest political efforts were sitting on the county zone of appeals. And that doesn't sound very sexy, but if you think about a suburban county where there's lots of development, there are lots of homes and businesses and streets being made, that zoning actually is a pretty important function. So he sits on the zoning board as the 50s end. He decides he wants to make a run at a circuit court judge position. He doesn't get that. He then gets removed from the zoning board by the Democrats who run the county council, and he takes this very personally. So there's a bit of the Agnew style we can see, and he decides he's going to show them. And so he runs for county council executive, the Baltimore County Executive in 1962, as a Republican, and wins in an upset. So he's showing that he can win here in unlikely and improbable ways, that he would win the county executive race in a heavily Democratic county. Democrats outnumbered Republicans in Baltimore County 4-1. But there was a sense in Baltimore County where you had a lot of new voters, people moving out from the city, that they were kind of tired of the old Democratic machine and they wanted a fresh face. And here is this World War II vet, clean cut, good looking guy, healthy, handsome family. Why not Spiro Agnew? So he spent 4 years as Baltimore County executive, but again, the fast rise to the top of the party in Maryland, now this makes him one of the leading Maryland Republicans and the most likely candidate to win in 66. When his term is up as county executive, throws his hat in the ring for Maryland governor. He easily wins the Republican nomination. And then he gets a huge break because the Maryland Democratic Party at this time nominated one last time a segregationist, a guy named George Mahoney. And this was just manna from heaven for Agnew, because the increasingly liberal parts of the Maryland Democratic Party, the suburbs of D.C., Montgomery County, for example, the Baltimore City vote, heavily African-American, there was no way they were going to vote for George Mahoney in 66. And so you have lots of Democrats for Agnew clubs pop up. And Agnew then wins pretty handily in 1966. Again, another unlikely turn of events where this Republican upstart wins now the governor's race in a heavily Democratic state. So he's in as governor. starting in 67, then he wins the 66 race. And the next step is opened by tragedy, and that is the Martin Luther King assassination in April of 68. And like a lot of other urban areas, Baltimore experienced a great deal of unrest. And Agnew, as governor then, decided he wanted to meet with the local African-American leaders of the Baltimore community. So they send out these invitations to about 100 or so local African-American leaders. They meet, and Agnew shows up with the leaders of the state law enforcement, head of the National Guard, head of the state police, all happen to be white. And this meeting was also televised, which indicates that there was some recognition that this is a pretty important meeting we're having here. And at this meeting, Agnew just lays into the leadership of the black community for the unrest. And he basically says, this is all your fault. And the members of the black community sitting in that room were instantly infuriated and began to walk out, most of them. And so this caused a huge stir in Maryland, this sort of showdown, if you will, between Agnew, who had at this time a fairly moderate reputation, suddenly swinging around and just lashing out at the leadership of the black community in Baltimore. Now, where this event then has ripple effects is Pat Buchanan, who was a young staffer for Richard Nixon at this time. Nixon had already thrown his hat in the ring for the 1968 presidential race. He's the front runner on the Republican side. They were already starting to look around for possible vice presidential running mates. And Buchanan liked what he saw in Agnew in this showdown with the black leadership of Baltimore. And he began to kind of relay this news and information about Agnew to his boss, Richard Nixon. And what they were looking for, if we step back for a second and think about the presidential politics of 1968, we have to remember that there was a wild card in that year, and that was George Wallace. George Wallace in 68 is running as an independent, and he is running as George Wallace tended to run back then, very aggressive, pushing hard against the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, the emergence of the Black Power movement, and finding some success. You know, we have to remember that at one point, Wallace was polling at 21% as an independent third candidate. So Nixon wants someone to blunt George Wallace's appeal on the right. But he doesn't want just a mere carbon copy of George Wallace. George Wallace is considered, a little bit crude. And so Agnew seemed to fit the bill. Here was a suburban, well-dressed, dapper governor from a mid-Atlantic state who was basically saying some of the same things that Wallace was in a much more palatable way. And that very much appealed to Nixon. So fast forward to the Republican convention, Nixon meets with the Republican leadership from various corners of the country, and Agnew is the compromise candidate. He is good enough for everyone, the sort of the liberal northeastern wing of the party, the emerging southern wing of the Republican Party, people like Strom Thurmond. And so he comes out of this, not very well known to a lot of people outside of the room, but as a governor, he was known well enough inside of that room. And so Nixon then announces that Spiro Agnew will be his vice presidential candidate. And it was an announcement that shocked a lot of people. There are a lot of people in the rest of the country were, who is this guy? There were real doubts about him. But on the campaign trail in 1968, Agnew had some gaffes along the way. But what Nixon knew was that he was appealing to the kind of people they wanted. That white working class, the suburban class, the World War II veteran generation, the people who are looking at some of the swirling changes of the counterculture, the anti-war movement, the Black Power movement, and they were wanting to say enough. And here was Spiro Agnew, who really seemed to be one of them, who was now on the ticket with Nixon. And of course, they win in a close race in 68. And there he is, just barely 2 years from being Baltimore County executive. There he is in January 69, being sworn in as the vice president.
That was one of the things that really fascinated me about this, is that what you just done is you focused on Agnew's rise in terms of Maryland politics, in terms of what was going on in with the Nixon campaign. But you also have this broader context in which it really seems that Agnew was so ideally timed. He's basically the right guy at the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
Not just in Baltimore in Baltimore County in the early 60s, or as the Republican nominee in 66, but he's also at the right moment nationally. That he's coming at just the time when you're starting to see this upswell of conservatism in America, and you're also seeing that the Republican Party looking seriously at the South as really, I mean, is there anybody out there who can check off all those boxes as squarely as Agnew?
I don't think so. The list that they put together, the finalists, if you will, for vice president. I'm not going to be able to think of all the names right off the top of my head, but they were all seen as being a little bit either too northeastern, right? And that at that time that would have been assumed to be too liberal. The Nelson Rockefeller wing, if you will, of the Republican Party, or a Ronald Reagan's name was bandied about, but he was thought to be too conservative. And so he really does. I mean, Agnew really does check the boxes very neatly, even if most people at the time hadn't really heard of him. But once they got to know him, and once they began to listen to his speeches and learn the Spiro Agnew story, the appeal is that he really does seem to personify and speak for this growing segment of the American population that is fairly middle class, fairly traditional in their views, that believe that the Vietnam War is difficult but worth fighting, believe that college is where you go and you respect the professors, and the professors are going to take care of your kids and not let them go astray, and when they look around the country in 1968, more and more of those people, again, what Nixon brilliantly tags the silent majority, more and more of those people are looking around at the country, and they're it seems like everywhere they look, they don't like what they see, right? Whether it's the hippies and the long hair and the pot and the rock and roll and the anti-war movement and the student protesters and the Black Power protesters and the women's movement starting to get underway. And it just feels like their world is coming apart. And who will step in to help them, secure and stabilize that world that as they know it, as they understand it? And, Richard Nixon, to a certain degree, certainly. But then Spiro Agnew alongside also seemed to really represent that kind of stability, order, respect for the law, respect for your parents, without being a total stiff, without just being an old fuddy-duddy either, because he was still a fairly young man. He's in his 50s, early 50s at this time. He was a dapper looking, as I said, handsome fella, nice looking family. So he looked like your neighbor. He looked like the guy you might see at your local barbecue, man in the grill, flipping the hamburgers. He looked like him, he sounded like him, and he said things that you and your neighbors would have been talking about as well. And so in that sense, he really was sort of the perfect guy for this time, for what the Republican Party and people like Richard Nixon wanted to do politically.
So he has this appeal and he has this audience. Does that translate into positions of great responsibility once Nixon is elected and they take over the presidency?
It does not. and here's where we get Richard Nixon. So Richard Nixon being Richard Nixon. So they did not really know each other very well going through 1968. They knew each other a little bit. They'd had some interactions. They'd had some meetings. But they certainly weren't close friends by any stretch of the imagination. There was a mutual respect. There was an understanding of what Agnew's role was, and Agnew obviously was very okay with that. I mean, my goodness, here's his ticket to, you know, the vice presidency. And after the election, there seems to be a moment when Nixon is really reaching out to Agnew and promising the new kind of vice president. So Agnew gets invited down to Key Biscayne, where Nixon had a place, and he's talking about how he wants Agnew to really, you know, have an important portfolio. He wants, you know, he offers Agnew some space in the White House for his office, which was a big deal. And so Agnew leaves thinking, okay, I'm going to be a really important, you know, vice president in terms of substantive issues, policy, and I'm going to be right there in the White House. Well, their term begins and Nixon's insularity then really kicks in, and it doesn't take very long. I mean, like in a matter of weeks, when Agnew has gotten the message that he's not going to be on the inside of the Nixon team. He's not going to be consulted for any important policy decisions. And this is frustrating. And frankly, Mark, he's bored. He's relegated to the usual traditional vice presidential duties, ribbon cuttings. You get to go to the funeral, and you know you're sent out to just sort of echo the administration's talking points, and for, you know, someone who had experienced the headiness of the 68 campaign, this just wasn't very exciting. So what he figured out, though, is, and here's where I think you have to give Agnew, there was a kind of savviness about him that I think sometimes people didn't see at that time. He understood that if he went out and basically went back out almost like on the campaign trail again, that he could carve out some fame and some notoriety for himself, but also he could help keep that support for the Nixon administration fired up. And so that's what he did beginning in the summer and fall of 1969. So he was, you know, the speaking schedule was about what it would be otherwise, but it's what he did with those speeches that really started to earn his keep, if you will, within the Nixon administration. And what he did then, and here he was getting a little bit of help, speech writing help from Pat Robertson, Pat Buchanan, and before long, William Safire. The speeches that he began to deliver in the autumn of 1969 were these rip-roaring, really campaign-style speeches where he is very aggressive and very much on the attack and calling out the enemies, you know, real and perceived, of the Nixon administration. He goes after higher ed. He goes after the kind of muddled-headed professors, and he goes after the student movement. And he goes after the anti-war movement. These are the times of the big moratorium and anti-war protests. And then the capper, really, in November of 1969, is in a speech in Des Moines. He goes after the media, and it works. And I'll just back up a little bit here. There's a little backstory here that I think is important. Nixon had given what we call his Vietnamization speech at the beginning of November in '69. in which he announced that he, you know, the emphasis was going to be turning more of the fighting over to the South Vietnamese. The speech was received coolly by the analysts of the day. And this really angered Nixon because he thought this was a major foreign policy address. And he expected, you know, some real traction coming out of it. And he didn't get it. And he blamed the television networks for it. And he, you know, Nixon being Nixon, he was always convinced that he just could never get a fair shake in the media. Well, a lot of politicians feel that way. But what's different about this moment was that Richard Nixon and Pat Buchanan decided to turn that frustration into a talking point, if you will, to make it an issue. And so in Agnew's speech then, so they got together and wrote this speech for Agnew to deliver. Agnew did some work on it as well, but it's mainly a Pat Buchanan, Richard Nixon speech with some Agnew touches. What he did at this Des Moines speech then was basically just make the accusation that the television networks were fundamentally and institutionally biased against Republicans and against Nixon in particular. And this just was a lightning bolt. This was a hugely controversial speech. And it was understood that he was singling out the television networks, but that he meant sort of the media or the press overall. And actually, he followed up with a speech the next week in which he said, yeah, I mean, the Washington Post and New York Times as well. I'm paraphrasing there, but that was the gist. And this, it was hugely controversial. And from Nixon and Agnew's point of view, it was hugely successful. It struck a chord. And a lot of those same suburban, white working class, middle class, those silent majority voters, the letters come pouring into letters to the editor, to Agnew's office, to Nixon's office, saying, yes, yes, the media is out to get you guys. And of course, that idea, you know, has stuck. So that was going into 1970 then, Agnew has real value now to Nixon. And he knows it. And Nixon knows it. And so they, through 1970, through the midterm elections, he's continued, you know, the tragedy at Kent State happens in May of 1970. Agnew dials it back just a little bit after that, but not for long. And then on through the midterm elections of that year, 1970, it's Agnew just hammering away at the press, at academia, at the anti-war movement, at the counterculture, and to the point where his personal fame has risen. During that time, Gallup does a poll where Agnew finishes third among the most admired men in the world behind Nixon and Billy Graham. So the second half of that first term then, going into the 72 reelection, again, we see Richard Nixon being Richard Nixon. Nixon was a little unnerved by how popular Agnew had become. He was also a little unnerved that they might actually start to lose a few more moderate and liberal Republicans. And so he sends Agnew off on various international junkets, Southeast Asia. And then by the time the 1972 election rolls around, with McGovern as the Democratic nominee, things are pretty well in hand. Agnew doesn't really need to do much. But he is positioned well going into the second term, so it seems, to be the front runner for 1976. So there was a moment in 1972 when Nixon thought about replacing Agnew on the ticket, maybe replacing him with John Connally, a Texan who had was in the process of leaving the Democratic Party to become a Republican. But to get a sense of just how important Agnew had become, Nixon mulls it over, has a few discussions with it, but it's made very clear that if you do, you're going to lose some important conservative supporters who wouldn't vote for McGovern, but they just, as they made clear, they just might not vote. So Nixon realized he was stuck with Agnew at that point.
You spend a chapter talking about the where Agnew fit in terms of the Southern strategy and the way that Agnew personified the Southern strategy. I was wondering if you could perhaps elaborate upon that just a little bit before we get to the end of Agnew's career. What were the Republicans doing with the Southern strategy, and what was Agnew's role with it, and what might that have portended going forward?
Right. This was, I think, one of the most surprising developments of our research was Agnew's appeal in the South. I'll speak for myself here. I didn't expect that going into this project. I hadn't really thought about it, to be honest with you. But what we see is how, you know, Eisenhower had begun to make some inroads into that old single party, Democratic, conservative Southern base. Eisenhower had begun to peel some of those states away, but the big question then is, well, are they there for good? Because you follow Eisenhower with John Kennedy and then, of course, Lyndon Johnson. But it did seem like then, in light of the Civil Rights Act of 64, the Voting Rights Act of 65, the Democratic Party more openly pushing toward the progressive side of the political spectrum, it did seem to Richard Nixon and others, but especially Nixon, by 66 or so, that there might be some votes to be gained there among white Southerners who are looking at the Democratic Party of their fathers and their grandfathers and their great-grandfathers, right? They're looking at it now in 1966 in the aftermath of the Voting Rights Act and saying, what am I doing here? Why am I still a Democrat? So there seem to be votes there to be gained. George Wallace emerging in 64 and then jumping ahead to 68 also seemed to indicate that there was a large body of white Southern voters thinking seriously about just not being Democrats. So Nixon was very aware of that. The key was, you know, how do you appeal to them? And I was saying a minute ago that, you know, Agnew was, as a governor of Maryland, not a stranger to the South. He's certainly not a Southerner by any stretch of the imagination, but he's not from Massachusetts, you know. And Southern Maryland, where St. Mary's College is, you know, today it's quite red, right? In many ways, culturally and politically, it still identifies as conservative. So Agnew then, as he is campaigning in 68, but then as he goes back out in 69, they send him to Montgomery, to, you know, Jackson, to New Orleans, to Houston, and they realize that he is striking a chord with those white Southerners who tend to be a little bit more what you call New South. They're business owners, they're professionals. In other words, you know, they're not kind of the stereotypical rural white Southern voter. They consider themselves to be, you know, educated, and many of them are. And Agnew appeals to them in a way that George Wallace doesn't. And really, to everyone's surprise, and it's really fun to read the letters that Agnew's receiving in the summer and fall of 1969 when he's given these speeches in places like Alabama and Mississippi and Texas and Florida, and the surprise in the response is really fun to read. They're just like, hey, this guy's great, and you can sense the unexpectedness of it all. But Nixon and Agnew, you know, they're pretty sharp politicians, and they realize let's keep going here. Let's keep sending Agnew to the South. An important part of that story, Mark, is the role that Strom Thurmond played, who had left the Democratic Party, South Carolina. Strom Thurmond had left the Democratic Party in 64. And Thurmond was in many ways a liaison at that time between this conservative white Southern vote who are looking to leave the party, the Democratic Party, and the Republican Party that Thurman was now a member of. So one of the things that I did as I began to explore this part of the story is I went down to Clemson, where Strom Thurmond's papers are, and where Harry Dent's papers are. Now, Harry Dent is a guy who worked on Strom Thurmond's staff for years, really well connected in Southern politics, and their papers are down at Clemson. And I spent a spring break during this time going through all of these letters, and you can hear, you can see just these references to Agnew in those letters. They're not even writing to Spiro Agnew. They're referencing Agnew. And that really said to us then, as we looked at those letters, that he's really struck a chord. You can see it kind of in the grassroots of these white Southern supporters who are, give me a reason to become a Republican. And Harry Dent called these people the switchovers. We got to get these switching over from the Democratic Party. And much to their surprise, Agnew seemed to fit that bill as well. He was, you know, he talked tough against the Black Power movement. He talked about respecting local traditions. Well, that's what they love to hear. And he wasn't George Wallace. And to those more suburban, kind of what we call New South voters, that was really appealing. So really, much to everyone's surprise, you know, Agnew by, as we even titled the chapter, Dixie's Favorite, Agnew by 71 is really heralded as you know, a kind of a local hero among those white Southerners who want to join the Republican Party, and many of whom are doing it too, and will continue to do that up through the 80s.
So you have Agnew at the start of 1973, Nixon's beginning his second term. Agnew seems to be in a prime position to succeed Nixon in 1976, the bicentennial year. And yet, by the end of the year, he's no longer vice president of the United States. His political career is over. How does that happen so quickly?
It's quite a story, and I'm guessing that some of your listeners have heard Rachel Maddow's excellent podcast called Bagman, in which she does a deep dive just on this story. Thankfully, when Maddow announced this podcast when it came out a couple of years ago, Zach and Jerry and I were, what's she going to do here? But luckily, she really zeroes in and does a terrific job on this case. What happened, though, Mark, was back when he was county executive and then as governor, Agnew had taken part in basically what was the kickback scheme for local contracts at the county level and then at the state level for, you know, again, Baltimore County is building lots of roads and buildings and bridges and homes and sewers. And, you know, there are just lots of local contracts to be had. And Agnew, like, as he pointed out, like everyone before him, plugged into the system where they got a little percentage for a contract that's worth 5%. If there's a contract that Agnew would get 5% of it in cash. So this had been going on for a while, and the Department of Justice, though, had been investigating this graft in Maryland for a while as the 70s began, but they weren't looking for Agnew. They were looking for his successor as Baltimore County executive, a guy named Dale Anderson. But as they began to crack that case, the people involved then began to say, oh, yeah, and by the way, Spiro Agnew had done it too when he was here. And now, so suddenly Agnew gets pulled into this investigation. And this is taking place through the spring and summer of 1973. Agnew, of course, they don't tell Agnew about it. You got to do your investigation first. But finally, he gets word of it. Summer 1973, he's informed that, yeah, you have been named in this investigation. And he instantly, you know, denies it. He's defiant. He hasn't done anything wrong. He's complaining that he's never going to get a fair shake because there are leaks coming out of the investigation, and so on and so forth. And as we go into the autumn then of 1973, the investigations are just getting closer and closer. And as we get into the autumn then of 1973, they signal to the Nixon White House that, look, we've got the goods on Agnew here. And it's just an ironclad open and shut case. We've got mountains of evidence that he's been taking these kickbacks, or he was taking these kickbacks, not only as county executive, not only as Maryland's governor, but unbelievably, he was still taking cash envelopes as vice president. It's unbelievable. These contractors would drive down from Towson or whatever, and they'd be shown into the vice president's office in the old executive building. How'd he do? Come in. They'd sit down. They would slide the envelope of cash across Agnew's desk. He would sweep it into his top drawer. Thank you very much. And off they'd go. Just remarkable. Anyway, they made it very clear to Nixon and then, of course, to Agnew's attorneys that, look, this is going to happen. And so he cuts a deal, and he cuts a pretty sweet deal if you think about it. He is allowed to resign. He pays a $10,000 fine for tax evasion just from 1 year, 1967. And that's it. No jail time. But of course, he has to resign. He's not vice president anymore. And so just as this is unfolding, he appears in a Baltimore courtroom and pleads no contract, no contest. And that's it. He leaves the courtroom and the judge says, you know, do you understand what this means? Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor. He's out. He's ushered into a car and off he drives. And that's it. It's all over. And one of the interesting, well, it's a lot of interesting things about it, but part of the backstory there, of course, looming over this is Watergate. And Agnew had nothing to do with that, but there was suddenly real concern in the Department of Justice under Elliot Richardson that you might have a situation where both the president and the vice president are going to have to resign or be convicted, right? And so the way this unfolded was that put a lot of pressure on the investigators to really try to get Agnew to resign, because they thought that would just be so much trauma to have both your president and your vice president gone at the same time. We're still in the autumn of 73. Things don't look good for Nixon, but it's still unclear as to, well, just how is that going to unfold? Here was a case with Agnew where the evidence was undisputed, and you had him, and you could get him out, and so they did it.
And that sets up your final chapter, which is, in one sense, it's a study in contrast, because you describe in it, you know, what happens in America kind of, you know, between this period and taking us up to the present day with the subtitle, Donald Trump's America, and how, right, you know, a lot of those trends that you describe that really have carried Agnew so far, you know, continue onward, and yet Agnew gets left behind. I mean, it's almost tragic in a sense, because you have this person who, as you explain, because he resigned, he doesn't get a pension, because he's associated with corruption, yep, Nobody wants anything to do with him, and you describe how he is in effect trying to, he's gone from being, you know, the president in waiting, the person most likely to step, mm-hmm, up, the person who seems ideally positioned to take advantage of what's going on, and it just all passes him by.
It sure does. It sure does. And what I think, you know, what I think connects him to today is well, a couple of things. One is, as I mentioned earlier, I think that I think historians are seeing this kind of conservative populism in the form of a Palin or a Tea Party, and realizing that it's you know, the Republican Party in many ways is you know, is not the party of, say, Dwight Eisenhower in the 1950s, and today it's you know, in many ways not the party of Mitt Romney. And so what's going on there, right? With the Freedom Caucus, for example. And so I think that's part of what has led us to go back and look at people like Spiro Agnew. But there is a more clear connection, connect the dots, if you will, between Agnew and Trump. And that's Pat Buchanan. Buchanan was always more conservative than Nixon, certainly. And he saw in Agnew the kind of political style that he thought, correctly as it turned out, would really appeal to these otherwise quote unquote normal suburban working class types. And this kind of feisty anti-elite energy that an Agnew brought to the trail, and that Pat Buchanan brought to his various careers as a journalist and a communications director for Reagan and so on. But then we have to remember that Buchanan himself ran in the 90s, challenged for the Republican nomination, and put a scare into George Bush at one point in New Hampshire. So that told Pat Buchanan that spirit was still out there, right? Agnew was gone, but that kind of political populism on the right was still there to be had. And they're continuing to vote Republican, but they're still voting for, if you will, more establishment types from the Bush family, for example. And there is there's a moment of intersection between Trump and Buchanan in the Reform Party, when they're both kind of this sort of fledgling third party in 2000, where they sort of intersect, but don't really have much to say to one another. But by the time Trump then throws his hat in the ring for 2016, he has sort of reinvented himself into what we see, into this slashing, attacking populist leader. And then by the time he runs for president, and as he wins, Pat Buchanan's delighted. Pat Buchanan looks at what has happened, and he feels vindicated. And he feels vindicated not only for himself, but he feels vindicated that the kind of the legacy that people like Agnew put into motion then has now culminated in a Trump presidency and an utter takeover of the Republican Party by Trump and by the sort of populist Freedom Caucus style.
Hmm. We've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Sure. So in the last stages of the Agnew book, I came across a couple of journalists whose columns just kept jumping out to me as being really, really insightful. And one of them is a guy named Richard Wilson, who wrote for the Cowles newspaper. He wrote for the Des Moines Register, but he was in Washington, D.C. He'd been he's the D.C. correspondent for the Des Moines Register going back to the 30s, actually. And Clark Mollenhoff, who also had these Iowa connections. And these were two journalists of a generation, kind of pre-Woodward and Bernstein, that were really plugged in and were really insightful. And I feel like there's, I'm not sure where this is going to lead, but there's more, to the story of that generation of journalists, that the kind of last pre-Woodward and Bernstein style journalist that is worth, digging into and seeing what I can find. And I've just done just a little tiny bit of research, in the Richard Wilson papers that are down at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library in West Branch, Iowa, which is a wonderful place to do research for anyone who's anyone who's interested. It's a great place to do research. So I'm just in the earliest stages, Mark, just really kind of splashing around and seeing what those papers look like.
Well, I hope those papers lead you to a great productive bounty.
Well, thanks. I'm encouraged. I'm excited. Both collections are large, And in discussions with one of the archivists down there, I get the impression that the word that he used was underutilized, which as a historian, that's music to our ears, isn't it?
Indeed it is. Charles Holden, thank you very much for taking some time to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thanks, Mark. You too. Appreciate it.